Welcome to the Friday Night Clive podcast with me, Clive Payne. In this podcast, we look back at the amazing charities, organisations and people we have chatted to over the past few months, all of whom have interesting and important stories to tell. Now, epilepsy is something that we've all heard of, but what exactly is it and who can get it? Tonight, Nicholas Swanborough from the Epilepsy Society joins me to talk about epilepsy and of the fact that yesterday was Purple Day, which is designed to increase awareness of epilepsy and to raise funds. And Nicola joins me on the line now. Hello, Nicola.
Hello there.
Thank you very much for joining me. First of all, tell me, what is epilepsy?
Well, epilepsy is a very common neurological condition that involves seizures that begin in the brain. So there are, you can have various different seizure types that aren't epileptic. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, if you've got low blood sugar or if you faint, or it could even be caused by something to do with the heart, but that wouldn't be classed as epilepsy. So epilepsy is very much seizures caused by an unusual burst of electrical activity in the brain. So where you've got millions of nerve cells firing off, you know, so whatever you do is governed by nerve cells firing in the brain. Mm-hmm. And if those, if the electrical energy, which sends the messages from one nerve cell to another, builds up in the brain and the switch doesn't switch that signaling off, then that is what can cause a seizure.
Now, I've heard of, clearly, seizures that you've just been referring to, but I've also heard people talk about vacancies as well. What's the difference?
Yes, well, yeah, so epilepsy is quite complicated. There are actually over 40 different seizure types. So all caused by the electrical activity in the brain, no matter what type of seizure it is. So the seizure type that most people are familiar with is the tonic-clonic seizure, where you would see somebody falling to the ground and convulsing, and their body jerks and they're not aware of what is going on. So that's the tonic-clonic seizure. But then you can have the focal seizures or absent seizures, where the person may be aware of what is happening, but they may zone out slightly, or they could be walking about, but if you try to talk to them, they wouldn't recognize what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Some people can become quite tense and slightly aggressive during a seizure, and it very much depends on which part of the brain the seizure happens in, and whether that spreads from one hemisphere to the other hemisphere, or whether it spreads throughout the whole brain, so it's causing a generalized tonic-clonic seizure. So the absent seizures are far more common amongst children, and we often hear that people with epilepsy, when they've been going through school, they've often been misdiagnosed as either being lazy or not concentrating, whereas in actual fact they were having absent seizures, and it's much better picked up now than it was in days gone by. And quite often children will outgrow absent seizures, but the focal seizures, where it's just starting in one small part of the brain, can often be quite hard to treat with the anti-epileptic medications that are available. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the areas where there is a possibility of having brain surgery for focal seizures.
Is there anything that actually can bring these seizures on, for example? Is it a lifestyle thing? Is it something that we do? Or can it just happen for no apparent reason?
Well, there are various causes of epilepsy. So it could be something genetic, where it's been passed on by one or both parents, or it could be genetic in that there's a change to your own genes, but that neither of your parents had epilepsy. Or it can be caused by something structural in the brain, for example, an injury to the brain or infection on the brain, such as meningitis. Or it could be a structural abnormality as the brain is developing. So there are many different causes. And there's also something called seizure threshold. So some people will have a high seizure threshold. Mm-hmm. So it's unlikely that the the brain would react to a build-up of electricity. It would be more able to cope with it, whereas some people may have a low seizure threshold. And we think that that is probably something that is genetic as well. So, for example, you could have a number of people, say, for example, 100 people, but it's not a it's not an exact statistic, but 100 people might have the same brain injury, say, through a car crash, and only one of those people would actually go on to develop epilepsy. So that's where we think there would be an underlying genetic reason why that person may indeed have a low seizure threshold. And then with the trigger of the brain injury caused by the car crash, that is why they would then develop epilepsy.
But it can happen to anybody, can't it? If it's a natural occurrence and not as you say, as a result of a car accident, it can happen to newborn babies. It can happen to anybody, can't it?
It certainly can. So the two most common times for developing epilepsy are in early childhood or over the age of 65. And over the age of 65, it tends to be linked with if there is structural damage to the brain, say caused in childhood by something like meningitis. So you may have scarring on your brain, or it could be caused by a stroke or cardiovascular reason, or even as part of Alzheimer's or dementia. So there are many more reasons why you might start having seizures. In early infancy, again, it could be genetic, or it could be structural, or it could be an infection. The febrile seizures are quite common in children, particularly in infancy, caused by very high temperatures. But that doesn't mean to say that they will go on to develop epilepsy. So you really need to have two seizures for it to be diagnosed as epilepsy. And it is actually very common. 1 in 100 people in the UK have epilepsy. So that's 600,000 people. So it's quite a huge number of people in actual fact, and yet the understanding, the sort of public understanding of epilepsy seems to be quite low. I think it is getting better with awareness days such as Purple Day yesterday. But yeah, I think because it's largely an invisible condition, unless you see somebody having a seizure, you wouldn't know that they have epilepsy.
No, that's right. It makes it difficult to treat though, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It does. I mean, first of all, it can be quite difficult to diagnose because you can't, you know, it's rare that somebody would have a seizure when they go to see their doctor or their neurologist. So it's very much about taking a person's personal history and getting witness accounts of what happened when the person had a seizure. And then they will undergo tests such as an EEG, where they wire electrodes to the outside of your head, and you're wired up to an EEG, so they can look at the electrical activity in the brain and see, you know, whether there's anything irregular happening. Or you might have an MRI scan, which is like a body scanner, but it would just be of your brain, to see if they can see any structural abnormalities that might be causing the seizures. And also, in actual fact, one of the most recent tools for helping with diagnosis, one of the most recent innovations really is the mobile phone, because if somebody's having seizures and if they can say to a loved one or a friend, you know, if I have a seizure, please record it with my permission, then they can take that video recording along to see their neurologist or their doctor, and that will really help with the diagnosis, because it depends what part of the brain, where in the brain the seizure occurs, as to how the actual seizure will be. So if they're moving in a certain direction, that will help the doctor with the diagnosis. So whereas when mobile phones first became sort of widely used, we were very worried about people posting videos on YouTube and sharing videos in quite a negative way about people's seizures, whereas now they're actually used as a tool for that diagnosis, which is fantastic because everybody's got a mobile phone in their pocket.
That's right. How do you go about treating for this then? I guess medication is involved, but is there anything else that you do?
Work. Yes, well, there is. The mainstay of treatment is anti-epileptic medication, and there are 26 different drugs.
Good Lord.
That are used. Yeah, which it does sound an awful lot of drugs, but in actual fact, they're different drugs for different seizure types. So, I mean, most people will, well, some people, their seizures will be controlled straight away with the first drug that they take, but quite a few people with epilepsy will try different combinations of drugs or different monotherapy. Mm-hmm. So for about two-thirds of people, their seizures can be controlled with the right medication, so which is fantastic. But then there's another 200,000 people, that leaves 200,000 people, whose seizures just don't respond to the medication.
We don't really know why.
So then there are several other options for them. So brain surgery, as I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. If we can see on an MRI scan exactly the focal point of the seizures, where that seizure is occurring, then that person can be considered for brain surgery, where they would undergo surgery to remove the focal part of the seizure. But then again, you have to make sure that that's not going to interfere with their speech or their memory or language or any of their motor skills or their vision. So obviously it's a very delicate operation and it's not undertaken lightly. But that is a possibility. And that is the nearest that we can get to a cure for epilepsy
sure.
at the moment.
Is there anything that we can do to guard against seizures ourselves? I know they always say prevention is better than cure, but, you know, is there anything by way of lifestyle choice or something like that that we can sort of minimise the risk of it happening, if you like?
Yes, well, certainly. I think leading a sort of healthy lifestyle, good nutrition, getting plenty of sleep, not putting yourself under too much stress, certainly not having an enormous amount of alcohol. Mm-hmm. Alcohol and drugs can lead to seizures. And I mean, whereas with stress, most people can deal with stress, but if you have epilepsy, then stress can certainly trigger seizures.
But the drugs you're referring to, you're talking about non-prescription drugs. These are, you know, what we class as illegal drugs.
Yes, yes, illegal drugs, yes. And excessive use of alcohol as well.
I'm with you.
So, yes, I mean, you could set yourself up for an epileptic seizure by, you know, those sort of lifestyle choices. And, of course, you know, if you're playing particular contact sports, if you protect your head, then that's going to reduce your risk of any injury to the brain. Mm-hmm. But, yes, being careful. But I think there's little you can do, really, to prevent it happening.
Sure. What do you do or what should somebody do if they think they're experiencing epilepsy? Maybe it's somebody that lives on their own, for example. Is it something that you can easily tell? I guess you would, you know, if you have the vacancy, then you have, as the name suggests, it's a vacancy, so you kind of don't remember that, I guess. And maybe if you have a seizure, you know, your brain, because it's not working correctly, you don't necessarily consciously remember that. But are there any telltale signs that we can look out for?
Well, I mean, we do hear quite often of people who are on their own, and it takes a while before they sort of put two and two together as to what might be happening, because they will know that something has happened, and they will wake up on the floor, and perhaps they might have bitten their tongue, mm-hmm. and they will have blood sort of around their mouth, or they will have injuries. But they don't know what has happened. But I think if you have any suspicion at all that something is not quite right, or you're having certain episodes, contact your doctor mm-hmm. and describe what is happening, or the fact that you don't know what happened, because that is equally significant.
Right. So, now yesterday you mentioned earlier on was Purple Thursday. How did this originally start then? And tell me all about what Purple Thursday is, or Purple Day.
Right. Okay. Well, Purple Day. In fact, it's not always Thursday.
No. That's what
that's a nice name
when I said
it.
That, I thought, no, it won't always be Thursday, will it?
No. It's the 26th of March, so it is a different day of the week each year, always with its different challenges, actually. So Purple Day is the International Day of Epilepsy, and it was started in 2008 by a young girl in Canada called Cassidy Megan. She has epilepsy, and she wanted to raise awareness of epilepsy and sort of teach people more about it, but in a fun way. So she created Purple Day, and I think probably it was really when social media took off that Purple Day took off on a really global scale, and it has gone from strength to strength year on year, and it's really been led by the people. I mean, you know, it's really led by our supporters on social media who just love to start the conversation about epilepsy, who like to fundraise for us. And over, well, I would say since 2010, every year it has got bigger and bigger. But unfortunately, this year it was a slightly paler purple, I would say, simply because of the current climate with coronavirus. Mm-hmm. Although Purple Day very much lives and breathes on social media, but people do like to get together. People have put an awful lot of effort into arranging cake sales and coffee mornings, non-uniform days at school, always to raise awareness and also to raise essential funds for us. And understandably, none of those could go ahead, so we had to move our fundraising onto a sort of digital platform. So people were able to still raise awareness, start the conversation, share photographs, share thoughts about epilepsy, which is all fantastic. And we have had people raising money for us digitally as well and donating. So people have been really incredibly generous at a time when there's such uncertainty and such worry about jobs and health and, you know, not having any contact. So we were really surprised and really impressed at how well Purple Day went yesterday.
What events took place in the UK yesterday, and how successful were they? Do you know, do you have that information yet, as it was only yesterday?
Well, I mean, in terms of events, there really weren't any actual events. I mean, we were going to be doing collections at stations. We'd got collections planned at Paddington Station and Waterloo and various other stations around the country, including Birmingham, actually. Mm-hmm. And we were going to have MPs were going to be tweeting about, you know, wearing purple in Parliament, etc. But we had to pull the plug on all of that, I'm afraid.
People were having events in their homes, weren't they, I think, as well?
Yes, I think there were some events in people's homes, which is great if they, you know, if it was sort of family based and everybody was in and safe. But they're sort of going out to community centres and going to people's houses down the road, or having events at school had to. That just couldn't happen.
No, that's
yesterday.
Right.
But we are hoping, in actual fact, that we may be able to have a second Purple Day or a Purple Day Plus later in the year.
Oh, I like
maybe,
the sound of that.
Maybe November.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good idea. I mean, do you know how much money has been raised yet? Again, is that information available to you yet?
Yes. No, it's too early to say.
How much money has been raised in the past?
So in the past, we raise, it's usually over £60,000 in a day, which is
brilliant.
Just fantastic. And this year, it did look as though we were going to be set to really break all targets, actually. We'd had 1,500 people applying for fundraising packs, which is always a good indication of how much money we hope to raise. So we were hoping to raise coming up for about £100,000. So, but we are really just grateful that we have been raising awareness of epilepsy, because there is still a stigma around epilepsy, and it's very important for other people in the community to understand about epilepsy and how to help them if they have a seizure. So that is all really, really positive. And we're very grateful for the people who are still donating nevertheless. And we really hope that we'll be able to have the bake sales and the non-uniform days come November.
Sure. Now, it's not too late to make a donation, is it? How can people donate if they still want to?
Yes, absolutely. We're really grateful. If they go to our website, which is www.epilepsyhelp.org, epilepsysociety.org.uk, and there are purple buttons that say donate all over our site. You really can't miss them. So just press on one of those buttons and it'll give you all the instructions for making a donation. And all the money that we raise goes to our vital research into epilepsy, and it goes to supporting our helpline and our information services. And of course, our helpline is really important at the moment, with people being isolated at home and huge worries about epilepsy and seizures and temperatures and the coronavirus. So we're really grateful. All the money that people can donate really helps to keep our helpline open.
Do you have the number for the helpline to hand?
Yes, I do. So it's 01494 601 400.
01494 601 400.
That's it. Yes. And that is open Monday to Wednesday at the moment. But from the 6th of April, we'll be opening 5 days a week. And it's also an email service as well. So if you can't get through at the moment, we've had to change the phone system slightly just to make sure that everybody can work in a safe environment with the coronavirus. So when you call through, you won't get our normal messaging. So you might have to wait on the line a little, but do please bear with us. And we've also got the emailing service if anybody has trouble getting through.
Super. Nicola, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you very much, Nicola Swanborough from the Epilepsy Society, for talking to Friday Night Live.
Yes, well, thank you for inviting us on.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Friday Night Clive podcast. If you like what you are hearing, don't forget to subscribe to get the latest instalment at blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, on with this week's episode. Now, tonight we're talking about autism. It's a lifelong development disability that affects how people perceive the world and interact with others. Autism is a spectrum condition, meaning that all autistic people share certain difficulties, but with being autistic, it'll affect each individual differently. On the line now is Terry Ann Coop, who's going to tell me more about autism and how it affects her daily life. Hello, Terry Ann.
Hi, Clive.
Lovely to chat with you, and you're live in your studio at home. Now, when you were diagnosed with autism, how did you go about getting that diagnosis to start with? What took you on that journey?
So it was a bit complicated. My family had been trying to get me diagnosed since I was very, very young, so from nursery age. However, because I am high functioning and a lot of the traits you didn't get straight away, I actually didn't get my diagnosis until I was 17, and I got it because I had a job. At the time, it was my very, very first job. I didn't do very well at my very, very first job, and they actually asked the question. They turned around and they said, you know, there's something that's not exactly that normal about you, in a nice way, they said.
I said they didn't put it like that, surely.
No, they definitely didn't. They went about it a nice way. And they said, have you ever thought about going to see somebody? And then I went through my college at the time and I got diagnosed through them.
Did they give you any idea, though, what those behavioural trends were that you were displaying that aroused their suspicions?
You know what, they didn't. And I suppose that's kind of a nice thing to do, because I feel like I'd have become really self-aware and tried to change myself if they did tell me.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but I always think, though, if you make a statement to somebody, you have to back it up with something that's credible. And, you know, if they'd have given you perhaps some sort of tactful signposting that would allow you to think, oh, actually, well, yeah, you know, I do experience that, or perhaps I do behave like that, and it would make it, you know, a little bit more softer for you, I think. I mean, do you think, is autism treatable, or is it something that you self-manage?
It's manageable. It's definitely not treatable. Like, there isn't a day that goes by where I feel normal, which, you know, sounds a bit sad, but I've come to kind of live with that now. But it is definitely manageable. And as you said, once you are aware of those traits that you have, you can rein them in if they get a bit much, or there's definitely ways to manage the visibility of your autism, mm-hmm. I suppose.
What sort of behaviours that you displayed that your parents picked up on? Because you said they were trying to get you diagnosed, but what was giving them cause for concern, I suppose?
Well, from a nursery age, I really, really struggled to make friends, something which I think I've become a bit of a pro at now, I'm not going to lie. But there was also things, the way I interacted with others, the way I interacted with objects. So apparently I used to count toys, and if any other child would come near me whilst I was counting, I would, like, hiss at them or attack them, mm-hmm. which... doesn't seem very nice from a nursery perspective. But, you know, there was no reason behind me doing it. It was just, that was the sort of thing I did, I suppose. And there were various things. Apparently, I mean, I don't remember this at all, but I went to speech and language therapy as a child because there were words that I couldn't even understand or grasp because they had different meanings. So like the word under or over, I'd take things quite literally. There were a few things like that that made my family go, oh, something's not quite right there.
So when your parents identified that, what was the next step that they took?
Well, it took a while to get me a diagnosis, and I suppose it's because...
How long's a while?
A while, in autism diagnosis terms, it took about 14, 15 years for me to get a diagnosis.
Good Lord.
People can go their whole lives without knowing, and people can be diagnosed straight away. And because it is, as you said, a spectrum condition, it's very, very difficult to kind of pinpoint those signs right away. Mm-hmm. It depends on the individual person whether you'll be able to tell if they have autism or not.
Sure. So your parents worked to get this diagnosis for you, and then when somebody, obviously a medical professional, sat you down and said, you know, this is what we think you're experiencing, what was the first thing that went through your mind?
I think I wasn't relieved right away. The reason I actually went through with the final diagnosis was because my mum was like, I think you have it. And I turned around and I was like, no, I don't think I've got autism, but I'll do all the things that you want me to do, and I'll prove you wrong. And then they were like, "You're autistic." So, yeah, it was a little bit of a funny one, but I think after it initially sunk in, I did feel relieved, and it made me more aware of the traits that I do have. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I've been able to manage them, and because of it, become a pro at things like making friends.
No, that's really good. But, you know, when you're sort of, you know, at work, or you're perhaps making new friends, it's not something that I suppose you would go around saying, hello, I'm Terri-Ann and I'm autistic. You don't, I'm sure, do that. But how do you deal with any questions that people ask you? Or... you know, I mean, because obviously you're not going to be labelled with that. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I kind of take questions with a pinch of salt. I know everyone's going to ask them, and it really depends on how people go about asking me. Normally, people can't tell right away, which is, I think, a win in my book. But if people do, you know, go, oh, yeah, I did notice you were a bit, you know, weird or a bit distant, I go, well, you know, I've got autism. If you've got any questions, ask away. And I kind of just answer everything with as much ease as possible because it aids the discussion, and I'd rather people talk to me about it rather than, I don't know, say things behind my back or anything like that. Mm. So I think it's just really, really important to have conversations with people when they do, you know, bring it up. And... to kind of rubbish any misconceptions, because a lot of people will be like, well, you don't seem autistic. And it's like, well, what does autism seem like to you then? And they'll mostly say things like nonverbal, or, you know, that you don't speak to people at all, mm-hmm. or stuff like that. And you go, actually, that's not exactly the case.
Well, as you say, I mean, some people can be very, very communicative and, you know, talk an awful lot. And as you say, some people can be nonverbal. It depends what type you've got, I guess. It's widely remarked that we're all somewhere on the autistic spectrum, even those people who are the perceived norm, if you understand what I mean. What's your view on that?
I think my view, I used to have that view. And then when I kind of lived with my diagnosis and kind of learnt what it was, because I didn't know that I was autistic until I was 17. I kind of had to learn what it was to almost be autistic. And because of that, I think that view is a bit of a cop-out, because
right.
I live every day with this, knowing that I am different to other people in a way that maybe some people don't see, but most people do. And a lot of people may have traits, but it's about the traits coming together to kind of show you are an autistic person, rather than saying, oh, that person talks a bit too much, they're a little bit autistic. It's just not fair, I don't think, to people with the condition.
Sure. I mean, okay, I'm a lot older than you, and in my day, things like autism wasn't diagnosed. But when I look back at my childhood, and based on what you've just told me, I think with me, and I'll freely admit this, I think there's a bit of autism there, because I'm not nonverbal. I am completely the opposite. I'm in the right job, really, if you think about it. But equally, I think, you know, there's certain situations that I find difficult to process or compute. Mm-hmm. And I think that's possibly the traits that I have. I mean, you know, I'm always playing the fool. I'm always the comedian, because I like making people laugh. But sometimes I'll just nudge it a little bit too far. So I think that mm-hmm. self-check valve that we all have sometimes doesn't work. Do you think that's a reasonable argument to say that, you know, there's possibly a trait there, a different kind of trait in me, maybe?
So I definitely say, like, people can have autistic traits and they can openly say, oh, that's a bit of an autistic trait, but it's all the traits that are coming together and how that makes you be perceived as a person is whether you are autistic or not, mm-hmm. or whether you view yourself as autistic. Because it's not only, you know, you can get the diagnosis, but there are people that go their whole lives without one.
Sure.
And they are autistic. So it's definitely something that you can, if you feel it in yourself that you are different and, you know, you don't perceive things in the way that maybe regular people or neurotypical people do,
mm-hmm.
you can still, you know, see yourself as autistic and not even go through with that diagnosis.
Yeah, I think initially my thoughts are that I'm quite eccentric, and, you know, I think that's a term of endearment, because I've been described as that in the past.
Me too.
But, you know, I quite like that. You know, I was never born just to fit in. I've always sort of, you know, stood out a little bit, and you know, you can turn that to your own advantage.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Especially if you're on radio.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, indeed. I mean, you know, you're on radio the same as me. I've done television, I do theatre and what have you, and I think it's benefited me, to be perfectly honest with you. But how has it affected your educational prospects and your sort of career aspirations?
I have basically always been told that I have a lot of potential, but I do nothing with it throughout my whole life. And it's because of things like being easily distracted or not being able to follow, say, a whiteboard or write something down quick enough. Or, you know, my short-term memory is quite terrible.
And, oh, mine's rubbish.
It really did knock me for a while. But I realised, and a lot of autistic people have this, that once we're doing something we love to do, we're actually really good at learning.
Yes, that's true.
And I think it's absolutely, like, in a school setting, when I was in a classroom full of 30 people, and bearing in mind I wasn't diagnosed when I was in school, so I had no help whatsoever, I was absolutely rubbish. When it came to GCSEs, I scraped through those. Even college, I scraped through that as well. And I took some time out. I learned a bit more about myself. I learned about the way that I work and why I work that way. And I decided to go to uni on a whim, and I managed to get in, which was quite surprising because I scraped my GCSEs and I scraped university.
What did you study at university?
Yes, I'm in my third year now, so I'm very, very close to finishing uni.
And what subjects are you doing?
I'm doing media, specialising in radio.
Good career to be in.
And what I kind of found out was, once I was doing something that I really did care about, it made learning so much more easier.
Because the passion's there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. And I think that was a very similar trend for me at school. Okay, I mean, I was at school in the 70s and 80s, but, you know, even so, I remember thinking about, you know, the subjects that I enjoyed doing at school, I was extremely good at. The ones that I didn't, probably much like you, it was a bit of an uphill battle, really.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I look back at it now and I go, oh, if I could go, I suppose everybody does, but it's like, if I could go back to school, I feel like I'd ace it now.
Yes. Yes, because you're in a better place, aren't you, I think, in your life?
Yeah, 100%.
How does it affect you socially?
I suppose it's different in a lot of different social situations. So I've got friends that I've known for years who, you know, they know me and they put up with me as much as they can or want to. And they very much just, they're like, oh, it's Terry, it's fine if I make, like, a comment which doesn't really land properly, or, you know, I laugh too hard at a joke because I'm actually don't really understand it or anything like that. But when I meet new people, that has to be, like, the worst feeling ever, because you never know how people are going to take you, and you never know whether you're going to have to explain yourself, so you've got all that kind of anxiety in there. And then you've actually got to kind of go out and you can try and be yourself, but what I've found that I do is I become this, like, overly confident version of myself, so that I'm not portraying the autistic traits, and that can be really, really draining. And at the end of the day, I have to kind of just go into a dark room and not really speak to anyone, because I've kind of exerted all of my social energy really quickly.
Do you find that you're blunt with people when you are communicating?
Yeah, I found that a lot. A lot of people turn around to me and they're like, oh, that sounded really blunt, or I'll notice it after I've said it. So I'll be like, wait, that sounded horrible, didn't it? And you know, sometimes I can catch it, sometimes not so much. But having been able to recognise that is one of the traits that I have has really helped, because I can kind of remember to think before I speak.
Yes, it's that little self-check, isn't it?
Yeah, I rely on that so much.
How would you advise anybody listening who may think that they have autism, or someone that they know is experiencing it? What's the best thing for them to do?
Encourage that person to be themselves in every single way possible, even during their worst meltdown-y times. Just encourage them to be themselves, because the moment you feel like you have to be someone else is the moment people actually start realising that you're autistic.
Sure.
But not only that, I would say always strive for awareness. You don't have to talk about it all the time, but letting people know, openly talking about it, is one of the best things I think I've done, because I suppose I've always been quite open, because when I didn't know I had it, I had to find a way to process it, and being open about it worked for me. But just, yeah, be unapologetically yourself, even at the worst times, because during that time when you're in meltdown because the train was too busy and you didn't have your headphones, you will thank yourself so much more for letting yourself go into a dark room and chill out, and you'll thank yourself so much more for being able to kind of take a break from the stresses of everyday life once you're accepting of the fact that you're autistic.
Sure. You know, it's been lovely chatting with you. A fascinating subject, and I've learned a lot in chatting with you. So, Terri-Anne Coop, thank you very much for talking to Friday Night Clive.
Thank you. It's all about you. It's all about you.
Black Country Radio. And if you want some more information about autism, you can go to the website autism.org.uk. autism.org.uk. And it was lovely to chat with Terri-Anne Coop. She's a broadcaster in Birmingham from another station, and she was chatting with me from her home studio. That's your lot for this episode. You can catch the show live every Friday night on Black Country Radio from 8 p.m. If you love our podcast, please subscribe by heading to blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. See you very soon. This is a Black Country Radio podcast, presented by Clive Payne, production by Andy Caddick and Alex Griffiths.